Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Faith Church Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Williams. Joining me today is Robbie Helene.
Hello, everybody.
And this is episode 14,812.
We've been doing this for decades.
Decades. 30 years we've been at this. I was just reminiscing about this, like 30, been doing this podcast since before podcasts were podcasts.
Yeah, back when podcasts were actually on cassette tapes.
Yeah, we were actually the first. So we invented the name podcast, and I remember 20 some years ago when Apple came to us and said, "Hey, we created this MP3 player, trying to name it. We really like the name you guys have used. Can we borrow that for?"
Sure, that was a big moment for us in our podcast.
It was, and I said, "Sure, for $1 million," and they said, "No." "We have more lawyers than you," was taken. I said, "Okay, how about $1,000? And they said, "No, we're just going to take it." And so I said, "All right, but I want you to buy us 2 Diet Cokes." And they said, "Fine." And I thrust my fist up in the air victoriously. And that was the day that I defeated Apple. So here you go.
Wow. I don't even know where we go from that, man.
We've gone so far off track.
I just thought people would like
to know how things started and like the early days. Now that we're kind of wrapping up this season, this is your last week in the office. And so I thought, you know, in this moment, I thought, I got to go big. Let's go back and reminisce about when David defeated Goliath and negotiated the terms for them to
use 2 Diet Cokes.
iPod. Large Diet Cokes. So... anyway, how do I do it? I've been in denial, so people realize that this is your last week in the office here.
Indeed.
And it makes everybody sad. So,
including me.
Yep. So I thought, what better fodder for your last sermon to talk about than one where I talk about adultery?
Finish strong and awkward.
Yeah. That's my thing. That's my jam.
So adultery.
You said that I mentioned several times, and I don't think I mentioned it several times. I think I had an illustration.
You had a couple of callbacks. Yeah.
I mean, I always have callbacks.
I mean, usually the first time is alarming enough, and then when you call back to it, it's a little jarring. We were beginning to have the seedling, if you will, of a conversation about why and when we use illustrations like that. What are you thinking through? What are you processing when you're using an illustration that we know is going to be uncomfortable or difficult for somebody? When you're going through the writing and the planning process, what are you thinking when you are choosing when to use something like that or when to use something that's a little more mundane?
Yeah, that is a difficult thing because I value a strong illustration that kind of just leaves it, like pulls the veil back, just lets us feel the weight of what's going on. I think that that's really important. I think, but you know, in this situation, if people haven't listened to the sermon, now they're probably going to, because that's in there. There's a hard illustration. I mean, the whole thing was about the gospel is disruptive. And I think, so one of there's a lot of things that enter my mind. One is I don't ever want to use an illustration that's tougher than it needs to be.
Right.
So I always, anything that comes to my mind, I'm assessing, okay, is this strong enough to make the point? And is it too strong? Is it unnecessarily strong? I always want to be mindful of the people that are, you know, in our congregation. I mean, obviously in any given Sunday, if you're going to use an adultery illustration, there are people who've been impacted by adultery. It's not a light topic. That's not an illustration that I would use humor in.
Right.
And I want to count the cost of that, because you don't want an illustration to be distracting from the point. You want it to make a bad illustration distracts, and sometimes that's tempting because you're like, oh, this will So I think there's a couple temptations we try to avoid. And when, even when I'm teaching, preaching to students, we'll, you know, talk about this, about illustrations, that you don't want, you want to be careful that it's not going to be actually be a distraction, which is the opposite of what an illustration is supposed to do. And you also want to be mindful that you're not trying to come up with a hard transition to convince the unconvincible. Is that a word?
I think so.
Okay.
I'll allow it.
So what I mean by that is, if somebody, if you don't want to picture the person who's hardened,
yeah,
who just is dead set against what you're going to say, you can't use an illustration that's going to jar them. It's going to be the person who's already soft and listening to the Spirit. And so, so that's where that kind of measurement of, is this strong enough to make the point? And then how far can I back this off? And it still makes the point. Is this a point that needs just a little nudge to the soft hearted? Cause you don't want to shame or beat down or discourage the soft hearted in there who are actually listening and are open and listening in the Spirit. But an illustration like that is typically when, okay, I know people are going to be open to this, but I want to reveal the thing for what it is.
Yes. Yes.
So I don't want to use a hard illustration to push somebody, because the person that I feel like if I need to push them, then they're not going anyway. The Spirit has to take them there. It's more to kind of lay bare the thing that I'm talking about. In this case, it was idolatry. I mean, in this case, talking about like idolatry is adultery.
Right.
It is, not just because the words sound similar, but because that is what idolatry is. It's being unfaithful and making the point that what we often have is people substitute all kinds of idols that they think, because they are close to Christianity, that makes them a better idol. So, you know, whether it's the idol of raising a family, if I idolize my family, or I idolize, you know, having success, you know, an economic success, or I idolize the American dream, or I idolize a political party, like whatever the case is, we often excuse our idolatry because it's very similar. It shares a lot of characteristics, right, and we think that makes it better. And so I was just trying to make the point of, yeah, but in the end, it's still adultery.
Right. And we'll use phrases like, well, it's the lesser of two evils.
Right.
I have to choose the lesser of two evils, which your illustration makes that seem super gross.
Right. Yes. Like if you're saying you're starting with the premise, I have to commit adultery, so I will choose the lesser of two evils in that. And I would argue you can also not commit adultery.
Correct. There is a third option.
That's a better option. Yeah. And then realizing in this situation, because it's difficult, because you still have to function in that world. So, you know, like if you think about in any of those things that I just mentioned, rejecting the idolatry of family doesn't mean I stop caring about my family. You know, rejecting the idolatry of the American dream doesn't mean I stop, like, you know, working a job and making money. And if I can buy a house, I buy a house. Like it doesn't, rejecting the idolatry of a political party doesn't mean that I don't vote. It's just wanting to really do a heart check and realize that, okay, these things in their proper place are gifts from God, but that means they are subservient to the King and the kingdom.
Yes.
And they all belong to Him. The other way is trying to have a foot in each camp and put our hope in these other things,
right,
and hope that God kind of adds to it or, you know, blesses it along the way. So that, I don't know if that answers fully the question. I think sometimes people wonder, do I just try to come up with hard illustrations? I really don't. Like I really count the cost, anything that I know is going to be shocking. And then when you do deliver it, like I tried to on Sunday, I tried to deliver it in a very soft way. So,
right.
The harder the illustration is, the softer I deliver it typically.
Yes.
Because it does not need me yelling on top of it or, you know.
Right. Because the goal of the illustration and the goal of Scripture is not to condemn. It's not to mock. It's not to shame.
No.
We're trying to help, as you said, like kind of lift the veil and shed some light on what is it that we're actually talking about here. Like how serious, is this thing actually serious or is it not? And so we're wanting to do that in a in a gentle way, in a loving way, in a helpful way. But sometimes that means like you have to reveal something that's really heavy or difficult or painful. And so we need the aid of an illustration to do that. And not to in any way diminish your creative prowess. The reality is like, that's not a unique illustration.
No.
Like no. 20% of the Old Testament is that
right.
illustration.
Right, right.
Like, so
well,
it's a,
yes.
it's a objectively, overtly biblical illustration that the prophets use over and over and over again. And so you're not being shocking for the sake of being shocking. You're doing exactly what the prophets did, which is to say, look, here's an earthly tangible picture to help you understand what is happening spiritually.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that actually is another one of those points is the harder an illustration I'm going to use, like the more directly related to scripture it's going to be. You know, we use all kinds of illustrations about all kinds of things of like, oh, it's like when you go to pick up your kids from school and blah, 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 whatever, to prove a lot of points. And those are great. Those can work really well. But if you're gonna bring something that is really hard to hear, then I want to have the firm footing of scripture
right.
and the prophets behind me of saying, yeah, this is what they've been pointing out for a long time. And that was one of those times too where I could have gone and quoted tons of Old Testament passages, and I probably should have, but it's the time thing where you're like, okay, it how
is. And the reality is they are much more harsh than the way you communicated on Sunday.
Right. And that's one of the thoughts I had was to communicate that and then kind of say, so if you think that's harsh, yeah. I actually am softening it
here's what Ezekiel says.
Right. And I didn't, and I kind of regret that. I think in hindsight, I wish I would have done that, but then that means something else gets cut. And that's just part of the deal of preaching a sermon and trusting that God is going to use it, how he's going to use it. And
that's right.
So maybe I'll do part two this week. I'll come up with a way to work that illustration back in there and then be like, all right, for those of you that think I was too harsh last week,
that would be pretty creative with this next narrative.
It really would be. So yeah. So how would you have taught this passage? So this was one of those passages where I, at the beginning, and
that's such a horrible question.
Yeah.
Well, here's how you did it wrong, Jay. No. I would have done it this way.
Hey,
instead.
I got thick skin. You, well, no, because I was frustrated with you because you took a passage that I love. Now, in your defense, I was across the world, so it was hard for me. I would not have been able to preach that, but you took a passage that I love in Acts and then left me with the riot in Ephesus, which is not, I just kind of look at it and I'm like, I don't know. I was, and it's so funny because sometimes if I'm just really stuck and I'm thinking, okay, what is the main point of this passage? Like, how am I going to preach this? And usually I go to commentaries after I've kind of written out a lot of ideas because I want to check, you know, make sure, okay, am I in the ballpark or whatever? We've talked about that before. But sometimes if I'm really, really stuck, I'll go to the commentaries earlier, not earlier in the week, but earlier in the process, because it's later in the week and I'm thinking, I need some help. I need and I went to commentaries and they were so not helpful because they were also like, I don't know, like just there was a riot and this happened. And I'm like, yeah, but how do you teach that? And like, there's a lot of passages in Acts like that where I'm left underwhelmed by,
the commentaries,
by the commentaries of like any kind of helpful stuff in it. Not because there's helpful things in the passage, but it's difficult. And so
the brainy academics typically like the more expository passages,
right.
the don't do that. You get a good narrative in there, story, and they're like, what is
right.
happening here? Don't tell me a story. Just tell me yes or no, and let's move on.
And that's what's happening here. It's a narrative.
It's
but
narrative.
You, when I said that to you, you were like, oh, what? No, this passage, and you were all excited. So I thought maybe people would benefit.
I do like this. I think this is one of the beauties of team teaching is I wouldn't say, like you said, all of the things I would have said, I would have just emphasized different things. Like, so you mentioned the things that I would have mentioned. The only thing that I would have done differently is just what I emphasized. So you emphasized like our place in the mob. And I, if I were teaching it, I would have emphasized like how we view the mob, like looking at the mob. So like you talked about that, you referenced that, just you referenced that and then camped out a little bit more on us within the mob. And I would have done the reverse. I just, I, when I read that, I'm so fascinated by like, and you read it and we can all kind of chuckle at, and nobody, you know, most people did not know why they were there.
Yeah.
That just so strikes me when we're like our contemporary, the context that we find ourselves in right now, like it's easy to look out and see like the us against them and kind of view the other group as a mob and kind of view all of them as equally the enemy. Like all of these people are equally against us. And I'm just so fascinated by like, there's a handful of people in this entire city. There's a handful of people who even know why they're there.
Right.
And they're kind of orchestrating all this thing. And the rest of that crowd is just swept up in this cultural moment without even realizing why they're there or what they're yelling about.
Right.
And I read that and it was just so reorienting for me to be able to take that step back and remember very few people in this culture are actually our enemy. Like actually want to do the church harm or see it diminished or whatever. And the vast majority of this culture are just confused, hurting people who are swept up in the cultural mob and don't even know why they're supposed to be upset about the things they're upset about or why they're supposed to be supporting the things they're everyone's telling them they're supposed to support. Like it's just like can so for me, I just I was hanging on how do I view the mob differently, and even though everyone is chanting, you know, against me, you know, I'm picturing those poor two dudes like who get pulled into the theater, and we Stacy and I have stood in that theater. We got the blessing of going to visit ancient Ephesus, and that theater still exists, and you can go and you can stand on the spot where those two dudes were standing
and watch Minions
and look up at this gigantic theater and see like if this thing like it says it was full.
Yeah.
And it's this massive, massive theater up, like just goes up the side of this huge hill and thinking, like picturing the entire city in there just screaming at you and how intimidating that has to be. And like thinking like the, you know, the equivalent now is the media, social media, like all these things that just feel like they're screaming, pointing the finger and screaming and just realizing, and most of the people don't even know why they're not supposed to like me. Like, so what if instead of viewing all of them as the enemy, we did, and you mentioned this in the sermon, like we saw they're being manipulated by a few. And so what if instead I viewed the vast majority of the mob as like, you're more like me than unlike me.
Right.
And what if instead of viewing you as the enemy, I viewed you as somebody that I should meet with compassion, knowing that you're getting swept up in something that you don't even really understand. And if I met you with kindness and compassion and listened to you and responded to like your actual felt need, like then maybe you wouldn't see yourself as part of that mob anymore, which is ultimately what happens in Ephesus, right? The whole, like there's a transformation of the city after this moment. John, the apostle John ends up moving there and is like the elder over the church in that city for a while. Like there's a massive transformation in there. So I don't know. I loved that perspective of most of these people that we view as our enemy are not actually our enemy. They don't even, they're just swept up in this big cultural moment.
That would have been good. We should do that. We should go back and preach that. It's so funny because, yeah, you're right. I definitely touched on that and that was a thing. And in my mind, I wanted to also point out how often we are in that mob and how often we, so it's easy to look at other people. And even if you get to that place and you say, okay, most of those people don't know what they're talking about. I was worried then about that, for people confirming, the people on the other side are just a bunch of fools. Like we're the rational people, you know, we know what we're doing. Right.
We never get manipulated.
Right. And wanting to like make it, try to point out that we are all in the mob. We all get swept up at different times. We all we all rely on the soundbite from the person that we see is in our camp. And we all, yeah. you know, I've been so guilty of that over the years in theological circles. Like how many times, I mean, I've looked at look at a book and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then I don't know the author. Well, what do? I look on the back of all the endorsements. Now that's yeah. good and bad.
Right.
But it's like, if I don't recognize the endorsements on the back, then I'm probably, you know, then I'm more dismissive of it,
right.
you know, and if,
or if there's the wrong name back there, then I'm thinking,
or if there's the wrong name,
I don't know if I can trust this.
Right. Yeah. And so that's just so tempting to do. And, now some of that is necessary, you know, like we can't possibly, like it always bothers me. I understand what people mean by it, but it always bothers me when people say like, do your own research, do your own. And I'm like, you can't. You literally cannot do all the research on all right. the things. Like, you know, you think about, you know, just whether it's medical issues or political issues or whatever, like, do you really think that what you can do on Google in 20 minutes is,
right.
is akin to, you know,
somebody else spending 20 years right. focusing on this and
right.
Right.
Yeah. yeah.
No, and, like, it isn't.
It isn't at all. And you can't, and the only way you can come out of that feeling confident is if you've bought into what somebody else has said and you say
right.
like, oh, well you find the expert who says what you kind of think might be the case. And then you say like, well, this is obvious. And like, no, it's not. So doing your research, like that's tough too, because you can't do enough. I think part of what can help us just slow us down a little bit is to be more open to reading other things, to just at least understand, you know, other points of view or whatever. But that's even separate from what this is, because this is just pure propaganda and mob mentality, which is different than actual different viewpoints. And so part of it is assessing and being able to identify, and that's probably part of what I wanted to try to do in the sermon, was to say like, hey, here are things that should pop up a red flag.
Right.
So even if this article says something that you agree with, you can still sense like this is propaganda and mob
right.
mentality, and I'm not going to cite this article. So yes, they may make a point that I agree with, but I'm not going to cite that. I'm not going to pass it along. I'm not going to be a part of that. Like I'm going to choose sources that are
yeah.
more rational, you know.
I had an interesting conversation with someone this morning that you just reminded me of. He brought up, I don't remember how he said it, but basically along the lines of you have to be really intelligent to be really wrong. Like to believe something that is super wrong, like you have to be really intelligent. And the argument, that's why I said I phrased it poorly, but
tell
like,
me more.
Basically the idea is like, if you just don't, if I'm just dumb, like then I don't really know anything. Right. Like, right. but it takes like when you get like the really kooky guy where you're like, you're reading something or you're watching a YouTube video and you're like, man, this is bananas. Like this crazy conspiracy is so wonky, but you have to actually mm-hmm. be a pretty intelligent person to be able to sure. follow the wrong path really well. Like you do a ton of research, but you just are doing the wrong research and you're trusting the wrong sources or whatever. But like,
right.
so the issue is not...
And you're making connections, the wrong connections.
You're making tons right. of connections. Right. You're just yeah. making the wrong connections.
Yeah.
Right. So the issue, you know, oftentimes you can say like, well, our knee-jerk response can be like, what are you saying? I'm dumb? Like, I can't figure out what's really true? And the reality is like, you actually have to be pretty intelligent to be super wrong about some of these things.
Because sure.
if you're not super intelligent, you're not even thinking about these things, right? So to follow that wrong path is not due to a lack of intelligence. It actually requires intelligence. It just means I've made the wrong connections or I've trusted the wrong sources. So in that research, I just listened to the wrong voices and assumed that what they said was accurate when it isn't. Which is why the do your own research thing is nonsense, because nobody, like everybody does their own research, but then you submit that, like before anything is published, it has to be submitted and reviewed, and other people then say, well, here's what's wrong about this, and this data is incorrect, and like that's how intelligent people actually go about research. It's peer reviewed,
right?
Right? Because if I do it on my own, I can make up whatever I want. And but I, you submit it to peer review so that someone can say, this source was actually like debunked. Like, you shouldn't cite that one because we figured out that source is an unreliable source.
But that's even changed. Like, peer reviews have become more tainted by propaganda and mob mentality.
Well, I'm speaking in a perfect world.
Yeah, and so I think that's what makes it more more difficult and more challenging. And that's where I want to bring all of it back to saying, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if masks are effective or not. It doesn't really matter. Like, and, you know, and I pull that out because partly just get you, because you think, I keep bringing that one back. But like, those are the kinds of things where you're just saying like, well, who do I trust? Who do I trust? It doesn't really matter. Like, I you know, and so even
unpack that a little bit, because that's going to be confusing to some people.
Because in the big picture, that we serve a God who has created the heavens and the earth and has rescued us from sin and has adopted us and is preparing a place for us and has called us to live by faith in him in the midst of this world, as the kingdom is already here and not yet fully realized, being faithful to him is like, that doesn't shift or change on whether or not masks are effective. It doesn't change on whether the vaccine is effective. It doesn't change on who's like the president or what laws happen or whether like all the different things that we worry so much about. At the end of the day, even if you're, what you're trying to figure out is like, what is the truth on this? It doesn't matter. And I point to Jesus. I tried to illustrate this in the sermon and I don't know if it landed or not, but just thinking of putting yourself in the shoes of Jesus and how often I find myself essentially thinking, yeah, well, if Jesus had to deal with this guy, then he would be totally different. No, Jesus dealt with, not only did Jesus walk the earth in a very challenging time morally, let's say, like, there are a lot of things that were horrifying in that era that we would all find horrifying, regardless of what end of the political or social spectrum you're on. We would all agree that many of these things that were going on at that time were horrifying. And Jesus walks in the midst of it. He is dealing with people who would mean to kill him. He's dealing with people who harm others, who completely misunderstand who God is and how the world works. And he perfectly knows. So you talk about, like, well, I've done my research and it just drives me crazy when people are wrong. Well, Jesus created all the research. Like, Jesus doesn't need it. Like, he created all of it. So he is constantly surrounded by people who are wrong.
Right.
Always. And yet he lived his life in this particular way where he was patient and he was slow to anger. He was compassionate. He was kind. He saw through all of that. He saw through the fact that what he saw were they were sheep without a shepherd. He saw them ultimately as confused, and not even in a condescending way, in a way that was actually like beneath them. Like, he came from underneath because he came to serve, not to be served. And so it's really striking. Right?
Like, it does get a little ridiculous when we're like, well, if Jesus had to deal with somebody as bad as this, Jesus was tempted by Satan himself.
Yes.
Like, if you're talking to the Antichrist, that's still not as bad as talking to Jesus, like, Satan. Like, Satan himself. And his response seems weirdly polite.
Right?
Right? Like, Satan is tempting him, and Jesus is like, nope.
And Satan's tempting him with scripture and with truth. Like, so Satan is not only, like, that's the, so even in that situation, you would look at it and be like, well, I did my research and what Satan quoted was true. And then you end up on his side.
Right.
Like, well, that's obviously, you know, there's just so many times in scripture where you see that it's not about determining. And how many times do people come to Jesus and say, well, who's right? And Jesus almost always goes with like a third way of like, yeah, neither of you. This isn't, and it's not about that. It's about there are bigger things. And so I think, is it important that we are, I think to the extent of being like responsible citizens, I think it's important that we're educated I think it's important that we care about the things that are going on. So I always feel like I have to balance that. I don't want people to hear like, oh, so then we just withdraw from everything. I'm not saying that. I'm saying we should be responsible citizens, and to be able to love our neighbor well means to understand what's going on and to understand, you know, to the best of our ability in particular situations, to kind of be educated on things like, but it's understanding that is all like under something that is much bigger and much more important. And at the end of the day, what I'm actually called to is to be faithful to God, which has far more to do with how I love people than my conclusion on worldly topics.
Yes.
And we get that confused a lot. We think that I want to be faithful to God, therefore I need to be right and have the right conclusion on this worldly issue. And how many times does Jesus basically have to say, like, you're right about that, but you're wrong because you don't love.
Right.
You do not have love. And Paul says this, like, you could do all of this stuff if you don't have love. And we just keep coming back to that and saying it's far more important how you love the people that are in that debate than that you are on the right side of that debate.
Right. That's hard for some people to hear, I think. I think it's hard, like, it's hard for me to hear because I enjoy being right about something. I like thinking that I have the correct view on any given position, and and in the past have been much more argumentative about that to try to convince you to that you should be on my view, on my side of an issue. And so that can be really difficult because we can default to the, but are you saying it's okay then to be wrong, like to be on the sinful side of an issue as long as I'm loving people? And I think to your point, that's where Jesus, that's the question they're asking Jesus, and his response is always, you're asking the wrong question.
Yeah, you're just asking the wrong question.
If you aren't loving, then you aren't on the right side.
Right.
Regardless of what your position is. If you aren't loving your enemy, if you aren't loving your neighbor, if you don't love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself, then you are on the wrong side, regardless of whatever the moral or ethical or cultural position is.
Right. And so, it's the first line of questioning. It's the same thing as when we talk about, you know, how do you choose what authors to read or, you know, what people to listen to. And I will always say, well, the first line is the fruit of the Spirit. If the person is not displaying the fruit of the Spirit, don't listen to them. Like, we're talking about theological, biblical issues. Like, if you say, oh, I love this pastor, you know, you should listen to this sermon. If they do not display the fruit of the Spirit, do not listen to them. Now, just because they display the fruit of the Spirit doesn't mean that they are speaking biblical truth. There is a second line there that, now I want to use discernment. Now that I've determined, like, okay, this person is kind, they are loving, they are joyful, they are, you know, I'm seeing the fruit of the Spirit. Now I can assess the content of what they have said. And similarly, I'm not saying, so are you saying as long as you're, you know, loving to people, which we interpret then as just being nice to people, as long as you're nice to people, it's okay that you're wrong. That's not, that it's just the wrong question to be asking.
That's right.
And I would say, you hit on it though. This is what I think is really important. So if people haven't really been, if they've checked out, hopefully they'll check back in for this, that the bigger issue than being right is we want to be seen as right. And that's where ultimately the problem is. The question isn't, like, where most of our problem isn't in the stances that we take. So when people say, like, okay, and I'll just go ahead and use pro-life because I think that that's a pretty universal Christian point of view. Like, we believe that all life is valuable, inherently valuable, regardless of what it's contributing, what that life is contributing to the world, like God creates us. And so the question is, do I have to be seen as right, or am I content to be faithful to God and to trust him in that and to continue to hold that view while I'm loving the person who disagrees with me and while I'm loving the people who are actually affected by it? Or do I have to take this issue and now make it my mission that everyone agrees with me and everyone sees that I'm right? Those are two different things. Yeah. I think our pride is on display when we realize, like, my bigger problem is people don't see that I'm right. We're not content we're not content to feel like, okay, I feel like this is the biblical, ethical viewpoint, and so I'm holding this, and I'm going to be faithful to God in that, and in my pursuit of Him and my pursuit of loving others, but my aim is going to be to love others as I hold this view. We're not typically content with that.
Yeah.
It has to be added on with, and I need you to see that I'm right and that you're wrong.
Correct.
And that's when it all goes to pot, because we've completely lost our focus, completely lost our aim. Now we've turned, like to your point, we've turned people in the mob into our enemy.
Right.
So that's where in the pro-life movement, you end up looking at an 18-year-old and making them your enemy.
Right.
Rather,
a terrified 17-year-old girl.
Right.
And she's the enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's not. Or when we talk about these gender issues, the 9-year-old who is asking to be called by a different pronoun is not our enemy.
Right.
And like, you can hold the view of like, man, I want people to know God knows who you are. God created you. You don't have to worry about that. You can be figuring this out, but God created you, and that is rock solid. And I can hold that view, and I can want to share that with people, and I can want to, but I'm going to be considering, how do I love that person? But as soon as I make that person the enemy, I now no longer can be right. Like, I'm now wrong because I've made them the enemy, which means I'm not going to love them. And as Jesus has commanded, I'm not going to be looking like wanting their restoration and wanting what's best for them and having compassion on them for being confused or being manipulated by a culture. I've now made them the enemy, and I won't be loving to them. And in that sense, I can have the right conclusion about that. But I'm wrong. I don't know if that, now that probably confused things more.
Well,
that's what the podcast is for.
That's right. To create more confusion and questions.
Yeah, to talk more off the cuff as we're like processing these things.
Processing out loud. Yeah. I think that's actually why people tune in. I think that's why both of our listeners like to listen, because we process things out loud. This is where you get the half-baked thoughts on things. Man, I think there's so much to that. I mean, we're already probably winding down on time here, but that's maybe for a future podcast, talking through that, because the other side of that coin that you made me think of was when we fear loving the enemy, when we fear demonstrating kindness, because we say, well, we don't want other people to think that we're affirming this position, this ethical stance, this cultural issue. So we don't want people to think that we're saying that that's okay. And so we need to be guarded in how we love, or we need to not engage at all, so that we don't, those people that were concerned about what they think of us, they might think that I'm okay with this thing that I know I'm not supposed to be okay with, which we've talked about before. Like, the one who is accused most of that in all of Scripture is Jesus, right? The religious leaders saying, like, what, are you okay with sinners and drunks and tax collectors and prostitutes? Because are you saying that what they do is okay because you're always hanging out with them? And Jesus' response is, yeah, because they're the ones who need me. They're the ones who are sick. And so a physician is here to heal the sick. So we misunderstand there again, because we're listening to the voices, our own voice and the voices of the world rather than Jesus. Our chief concern becomes, well, I need them to know that I'm right. I need a certain group to know that I'm right. And I need another certain group to know that I am against this thing over here.
Yes.
And the really unfortunate aspect of that is the only people that I'm caring about in that are other religious-y people, because the person that I'm loving typically does not ever think that, right? It's just this other group that also doesn't want me to love the mob, and I'm concerned about them. I hear Paul's voice in Galatians, I think it is, when he says, like, if I was concerned about men, I would not be a servant of Christ.
Right.
Like, I can't be both of those things. I cannot be living for the opinion of man and living for the opinion of Christ, because those things are in constant conflict with one another. And are we okay with saying, but Jesus said we should love them, even if that means some people who are not loving that group think that I'm affirming the wrong things?
That's really good. Yeah, we are afraid of that. We're actually looking for the approval of men who are not honoring Jesus. God.
Right, who are not listening to Jesus.
You just described the crowds that Jesus dealt with to a T, and that is what we're dealing with. And you and I have both had experiences where we have had incredible opportunities to share the gospel because people, non-believers, would view us as, you don't agree with me and yet you love me, and so I trust you.
Right.
Like we have earned a place to be able to speak into a lot of those things because they trust, like there's a trust there because they know. And it's not because because that is another temptation. We've talked about that before. The flip side is like, okay, well, I want to be loving. That means I have to condone everything. That means I have to go along with all this because I don't want them to think I'm not loving. The reality is, if you're talking about the vast majority of people, the vast majority of people that you're trying, that God would call you to love and serve, your disagreement with them and then loving them in the midst of that disagreement is more evidence, is a stronger case for your love for them than if you're just kind of going along with everything. And yeah, we obviously want to be careful of, just ushering someone down the path of destruction because we are afraid to say something. We're afraid that maybe they'll think that they'll think we're not loving. And remembering that the only opinion that matters about whether I'm loving or not is God's. Right. He's the one who defines love because he is love.
Right.
And his word defines it for us. And Jesus, thankfully, explicitly gives those examples in the Sermon on the Mount so that to respond to that, even, when you look at the Sermon on the Mount and the Good Samaritan, it's really difficult to find the loopholes that we're always looking for and the fears that we typically have. It pretty much answers it. Like if you have fears of any of those things, read the Sermon on the Mount, read the Good Samaritan, and then say, okay, is that something that Jesus would want me being concerned about? Or would he say, you know what, go ahead and love that person. And if religious people who don't actually know me judge you for that, well, then you are in good company because you just named exactly how they treated Jesus, how they treated Paul, how they treated Peter. Like you're in great company if you are judged by religious moralists who think the most important thing is you have all the right stances. And on the flip side, if you find yourself trying to appease the other side by compromising and not putting your trust, like, because ultimately then you have to make a decision of, does God define what is loving or does man? And so if man tells you, well, this is what's loving. So does God define what truth is or does man? And so if man says, well, truth is just having the right conclusions on the right facts. Well, that's not what Jesus says. So I'm going to trust that. But on the flip side, man might define love in a certain way. Like love means that you let me do whatever I want. And God says, no, that's not actually what loving is.
Right.
And so do I trust God when he says, do I trust that he's more loving than I am? Or that, or do I abandon that and say, no, I think the mob defines love better than God does. Mm. So it's, these are both intention.
Yep.
And honestly, all of us know, I think all of us, if we're honest, we kind of know which ditch we might have a tendency to fall into. And the hope is that this is part of the reason why being in community is so important, because we do kind of balance each other out. We do kind of help one another. When it's helpful to me when someone brings a concern and they're like, well, aren't you worried about this? Like that can be helpful, because sometimes I can be like, you know what? Maybe I do need to be a little more intentional about communicating, this truth. And I'm so pushing on the other side that sometimes I can forget, like, hey, I need to make sure that I'm not being like swayed by the mob and always trying to like position myself against this mob or against that mob, and just be like, sometimes I just got to say, well, this is what it is. And know that some people are going to use it for these, and pervert it in this way. And some people are going to twist it and use it in that way. and just be like, all right, God, you use it. And so, we need people. We need people who are going to push on our, and push us out of our comfortable areas. And so that's why the church exists. It's why we need to be together.
That's right.
And so hopefully this is one of those resources that we just kind of put out there to help get the wheels spinning. We, intentionally don't reach any, big conclusions. This is not like a 3-point teaching process. Obviously not polished, but if it has sparked something in you and you're wondering and you have questions now and you're thinking, okay, well then what do I do? And we especially love it when somebody says like, so what do I do? How do I love my neighbor who's in this situation? And I strongly disagree with like the way that, you know, with their point of view or the way that their lifestyle or whatever. And that goes against what I believe is honoring to God. And so how do I love them and still point them to Jesus? Like these are the situations that we love to get into and help you walk through, because the reality is God has placed you there and for a reason. And it's not an accident. Absolutely. And avoiding it is not going to be the answer. He's put you there. So your calling is definitely to be faithful in that. And we want to help you do that well. So if you have questions, talk to us on a Sunday, email us at connect@faithpeshtigo.com, or go to Colorado and track Robbie down.
Please do. Please visit.
I should have let you land the plane. If this is your last official, I don't think it's going to be your last appearance on the podcast.
But no, surely not.
Surely not.
That's through the wonders of modern technology. It will seem like I'm still in the room. I'll just be,
sometimes
physically far away.
Well, why don't you? Do you wanna land? I just landed it most of the way, but now.
All right, then I'll put on the brakes with a, we love you. We're thankful for each of you, and until next time, grace and peace to you.